Chapter 3. The white worm members who left Han in the swamp aren't back at the ship when John and Han make it out, and Han insists that John wait outside while he slips in and retrieves his few possessions from their freighter. John spends most of the time he's out of sight sitting on their makeshift boat and meditating, because that's the best way he knows how to deal with tension. He trusts that Han can take care of himself in most situations. If he's managed to survive the gang this long already, knows that Dark Woman would chide him about attachment and trying to possess people, and the dangers that arise when Jedi care about one person over others instead of for people in general, but this isn't attachment. John, of all people, knows how to drag all his flaws out into the light and tear them apart. This is worry for Han, because he's been through too much, and John doesn't want him to have to face more strife if it can be prevented. The White Worm is a small-time gang and shouldn't have much reach beyond Corellia itself, but John still wants to be cautious. If he hears anything or feels anything, it will be the work of a moment to get to Han and help him. Letting people suffer unnecessarily, even when it's potentially for their own good, isn't something John has ever been able to bear. Of course, being in the spaceport puts John close to Slave One, and he can't keep his eyes from straying in that direction. It's out of sight behind a tangle of swamp trees, but John knows it's there. He can't stop thinking of Jango on the ship, grief in him that slid right into fury. Deserved, all of it. What happened on Galadron was a tragedy, and the Order was culpable. They should have done research, shouldn't have trusted so readily. Situations like that are the reason Jedi like Dark Woman exist, after all. Subtle and sly and good at ferreting out secrets, no matter how deeply they're hidden. If Dark Woman had been there, maybe the true Mandalorians wouldn't have been carved away, cut down one by one and imprisoned, lost from what John knows of Jango. It aches somewhere, deep in his chest. And John curls his hands together, closes his eyes. The Jedi Order isn't perfect. It's made up of flawed beings, beholden to a Senate made up of more flawed beings. There's no way to avoid some amount of failing in the face of that, but the Battle of Galadron was too many failures, too much pressure from outside sources, and not enough clear thinking from the Jedi involved. It's the kind of thing Dark Woman always loathed in particular. Her belief in the Force is a powerful, almost overwhelming thing, as is her belief in the Order. But she sees its shortcomings as well as anyone. That's why her last order to John as his master was to never set foot on Coruscant unless absolutely necessary, to avoid the political trappings of being a Jedi, and simply do the work of one, stripped down to its essentials. John has many, many feelings about Dark Woman, all of them complicated, but she wasn't wrong. He can't sense Boba on the ship, but he doesn't stretch his senses out towards the town proper to look for him. Assumes he's well enough if he's allowed to roam freely. Jango got angry, but there was nothing John sensed in him that would ever take that out on his son. So John feels settled about that, at least. Less about Jango in general, but between the flickers of guilt for what he suffered because of the Jedi, and the small bits of admiration for what he's made himself into, John expected that. He hurt the man, bringing up Galadron. Hadn't meant to, but had done it anyways. At least he spoke his piece, made the Jedi's culpability clear, made some attempt at an apology, no matter how worthless. Jango won't forgive, but that's fine. That's his right as the one wronged so deeply. And all John can do is lay the apology before him and be content with that. Sighing a little, John pulls his attention from the empty Slave One, fishing his comm out of his belt pouch and turning it on. It whirs at him, the light flickering as a missed message registers, and John checks the code. It's not one he recognizes, which means it's likely Faye's. She doesn't carry a comm herself, but she's been known to borrow them from passerby when she wants to get in touch. Of course, that means John can't exactly comm her in return. He's learned that lesson well, and it was awkward. Amused and resigned in equal measure, John settles on Nico's code instead, given that Nico is far less likely to be in the middle of a bar brawl or a fight with pirates. Usually. He has Tay now. That generally makes him at least pretend to be more restrained than Noel, even if, in truth, he's just as bad as she is. Worse, maybe. Noel at least keeps her battles to enemies of the Republic. Nico doesn't give a damn if they're friends, enemies, or allies, as long as he thinks they've done something wrong. Master Antilles, hello, a voice says a moment later, and it's faintly breathless, more than a little chagrined. John pauses, reassessing his estimate that Nico is the better one to call. Padawan Tay, he says, wary. I was fairly certain I was trying to reach your uncle. Oh, Tay says, but not like he accidentally picked up Nico's comm, more like he was hoping John would take it as a wrong code and end the call. Right. Yes, were you? With a snort, John sinks back, shifting out of his kneeling position to cross his legs beneath himself. Tay, where's Nico? He asks, already amused. There's a quiet sigh over the line. He's nearby, Tay says dutifully, like that's what he was instructed to say. When John hums, unimpressed, he can practically hear Tay's wince. Sorry, Master Antilles. Master Dooku is presenting a speech at this academy tonight, and I think Uncle Nico is investigating. At that, John winces too. If Dooku is speaking, Nico is probably going to pick a fight. You're at a distance? He asks. I don't do well with crowds yet. Tay pauses, and then offers. Master Venari is here, too. Well, apparently John should have just called her. Is she with you now? There's a pause, a rustle, and then Noel's dry voice comes over the link. Vagabond, up to your usual tricks? No infiltrating the Bounty Hunters Guild this time, John says, and eyes the Corellian freighter in front of him. Noel, do you know about the White Worm Gang from Corellia? For a moment, all John can hear is silence. He can practically see Noel wrinkling her nose. She's an equine bothan. That's a lot of nose to wrinkle. Getting into Core World street crime now, Vagabond? Even if you are, you can do better than them. John snorts softly. I found a boy, he says. He was one of theirs, but I'm taking him with me. Adopting a Padawan? Noel asks interestedly. He force sensitive? John blinks. He hadn't considered that. Hadn't even thought to check, but there's a long, long history of Jedi being drawn to force sensitive children. To the point that fate seems to bend around them and wring coincidence out of the most improbable circumstances. His meeting with Han wasn't quite that, but there were certainly shades of it. I'm not sure, he says slowly, but he's too old to be a Padawan. Noel grunts. It doesn't change the fact that he'll need at least some training if he is, she says. And then, you coming to join us? I might need help keeping Nico from kicking Dooku's ass all the way back to the temple. Did you know Faye calls it a lover's spat? John asks, amused. Noel makes us sound like a lolthcat choking on rat bones. Don't even say that, Antilles! Wait, Uncle Nico and Dooku? Tate cuts in, sounding delighted. Is that why he's so mad at Dooku all the time? Ask your uncle, Noel says with a sigh. I don't want to think about it. Dooku's a prick. He's well respected, John offers quietly, and Noel groans. He trained that airhead Qui-Gon Jinn, she says, and Nico hates him. I'm reserving judgment. That, John allows, is probably a good idea. Nico was crush mates with Dooku. He probably knows him better than most. With a sigh, he tugs the band out of his hair, leaning forward to brace his elbow on his knee, and runs his fingers through the tangled strands. There's mud caked in his hair, and he needs a bath. Now that he has Han, sleeping in trees probably isn't all that feasible anyway, so he should likely find himself a room somewhere. The town has an inn. He can afford it, given how few of the mission credits that the temple sends out he actually uses. Is Nico going to speak with Dooku? He asks quietly, and there's an itch at the back of his mind, something unsettling, uncomfortable. For a given value of talking? Noel pauses, then groans loudly. I don't mean that the way it sounded. Tay's laughter is muffled, but definitely still audible. He was hoping to talk to him after his presentation, he says. Something about the corruption of the core worlds and stagnation in the Republic. John snorts softly, because if Dooku really wanted to help the Outer Rim planets, he'd try and reform the Senate, which is where pretty much all of the stagnation is. The Jedi can't, from their position. They've lost most of their autonomy over the years, and now they're practically an arm of the Senate, bound up and blunted and stripped of their teeth. But a former Jedi, one with a position and political ties like Dooku's, if he wanted, he could shake the whole foundation of the Senate. But he'd rather give dramatic speeches in the Rim and incite people to violence. Tell Nico to ask him about Galadron, he says on impulse. Though that's too kind a word for it. This is a thing with teeth that bites at his spine, settles into his nerve endings. Galadron is important. Dooku is important. Jango is important. And his ties to both Dooku and Galadron matter in a way John can't quite put into words. And Jango Fett, if he can. There's a moment of silence, and then Noel huffs. I don't know what Anya did to you to kick your instincts into overdrive, but they're not usually wrong, she says frankly. I'll tell him. Don't hold your breath, though. The odds of it turning into a lightsaber duel before they've said 10 words to each other is high. They'd rather wave their swords at each other rather than behave like reasonable adults. Another pause, and she groans again, louder. I didn't mean that the way it sounded either. Damn you for putting that thought in my head, Antilles. John muffles a soft laugh behind one hand. I'm staying on Ides for the time being. An earthquake released chrysalids from an old Sith workshop here. I need to kill them. Well, if anyone can, I have faith it will be you, Noel says, a little dry. One fewer cool head to help keep Nico in line. But I suppose I can manage in a pinch. Faye tried to calm me, John offers. She'll probably try you next. Have her come help. Noel makes a thoughtful sound. If anyone can pry Dooku's secrets out of his head, it's Faye. And she won't hesitate if she thinks something's off, she allows. You think he's that much of a threat? I don't know, John says quietly. But something is telling you he is, Noel finishes for him. Well, I'm inclined to trust you, Vagrant. If she reaches out, I'll ask her to meet us. Leaves you without backup, though. John hums. There's a bounty hunter on the moon, he says. I'll hire him if I need help. Which bounty hunter exactly? Noel asks warily. Jango Fett, John says, perfectly even. And Noel curses instantly. John Antilles, don't you dare hire the Jedi killer for your damn mission, she says. I'll come out there myself and drown you in the swamp. Footsteps, and John switches off the comm without regret or hesitation. Han, he says, glancing up, and rises from the log. You have everything? Han is clutching a ratty bag to his chest, looking a little shifty. Yeah, he says, and John rather suspects that he's got more than just Han's belongings in the bag. But, well, he's certainly not about to tell Han what to do. Where's your ship? Is it that cruiser? I don't have a ship, John says. When Han squints at him in disbelief, John sighs through his nose and says, I was going to get a room at the inn. That, at least, makes Han brighten. Okay, he says, and falls into step with John, heading back towards the town proper. Can we get real food, too? Of course. There is, maybe, a trace of panic bubbling up in John's chest. Something deep-seated and desperate beneath the certainty that he needs to do something. He has no idea what to do with the child. No concept of taking care of anyone long-term. The most he usually manages is finishing a mission, helping people back to somewhere they can get reliable assistance, and then disappearing again. But Han is going to need things. He's going to need John, at least until John can figure out somewhere for him to go that's safer. John's never done anything even vaguely like this before. But Han is talking about sweets he stole on Corellia, cheerful and excited, and some of the wary anger from the swamp has been buried beneath everything else. John watches him for a moment, not quite able to help a smile, and he's never taken a Padawan, because he's always been terrified that he'll end up just like Dark Woman. But Han isn't his Padawan, might not even be Force-sensitive. There's no need to worry about training him. It means John can relax and help him without worrying about his own hang-ups, and that's enough to know. Jango failed to take the shot. The knowledge seethes in his chest, something burning and furious and almost guilty, wound through with something like resignation. And as Jango hits the dock, he snarls to himself, kills the thrusters on his jetpack, then turns, stalking into the raised streets. There's rain threatening and no one is out, which is almost disappointing. He could use a few lowlife smugglers to take his anger out on right now, but Jango's breath rasps in his throat, and there's heat in the pit of his stomach, and he's angry about it. Maybe it's that Jango has hunted Katarns before, knows precisely how dangerous they are. Maybe it's that he arrived just in time to see the thing, twice the size of the Katarns the Wookiee dragon riders use as mounts, if not more. Karking disembowel the idiot Jedi, and then the idiot Jedi kept fighting, like a mortal wound wasn't worth more than a passing moment of irritation. Django's fought a lot of Jedi. He's used to the poised swordsmen, the cool bastards too good for a bit of violence, the diplomats who wouldn't be out of place in any stuffy Senate audience chamber. All of them make him want to put a blaster bolt in the middle of their chest, just to make them react. They're not warriors, not the way Mandalorians are warriors. And the fact that people in the galaxy try to draw comparisons makes Django furious, but this Jedi, somehow, in some way, actually fights like a warrior. There was no pithy banter, even with an opponent who couldn't understand it. No attempt to draw the creature off or ease it back from violence. No hesitation, no pause, just calculation and action and reaction. A willingness to take a blow that should have been fatal, and a complete, unhesitating focus on defeating the enemy. That was a hell of a fight. It's the kind of fight Django always looks for. Quick, brutal, pushing the fighter to their limits, with even a moment of doubt ending in death. And the Jedi had arisen to the challenge in order to protect the kid. And then, in the aftermath, he'd taken the kid in. And there was no hesitation in that, either. Ahead of Django, there are voices. Low, an edge of brown-green fabric flickers in the rising breeze, swirled out of the mouth of a narrow, meandering walkway, cutting back towards a row of shops. The Jedi is crouched down, listening to the boy he saved. And he's still got his hood up, is still wrapped almost completely in tattered cloth. But it's clear all of his attention is on the kid. As Django watches, the Jedi produces a credit chip, offering it up, and the boy grins, taking it eagerly. "Remember the room code?" the Jedi is asking as Django comes to a halt, listening. "Of course," the boy says, like he's insulted the Jedi would think otherwise. "I can take care of myself." "I know," the Jedi says, and there's warmth in his voice. "But try to be back before nightfall. We can find somewhere to eat." The boy looks like he's trying to hide his excitement, full of the same kind of desire to be cool that still trips Boba up all too often. "I guess," he says, and then, careful. "You're not going to go after those Sleemos, are you?" "The White Worm Gang? No, not unless they come after me first." "Okay." The kid relaxes a little, then says, "You smell like swamp. You should take a bath." The Jedi sighs a little, but it mostly sounds amused. "I will. Stay out of the swamp. Don't get caught." That makes the kid grin. And he turns and heads down the walkway at an almost run. The Jedi watches him go for a long moment, then rises to his feet and turns, facing Django without hesitation. The drape of his hood hides his face, and the extra folds of his cloak makes it hard to pick out his form, but there's enough of a gap for Django to see torn tunics, a flash of skin beneath, a flash of scar beneath. And there's something hot and heavy in the pit of Django's stomach that isn't going away. "Fett," the Jedi says, not wary, not wavering. Django knows his own reputation, has cultivated it carefully. If this Jedi fears him, though, even slightly, Django can't see any trace of it. There's caution, but just like that moment in the cantina, it's one predator to another. "Jedi," Django says, and stalks forward. His hand twitches towards his blaster, and the Jedi stills, alert, aware, ready to move. Django's breath rasps in his throat, and he bulls close, grabs the bastard by the neck of his robes, and shoves hard. The Jedi's back hits the wall, and Django reaches up, yanks his helmet off, lets it drop as he steps closer, pushing the Jedi back into the boards, and grabs his hood, wrenching it back. Even that doesn't make the Jedi move. He just stares at Django, pale eyes narrowed, dark hair tangled around his face and lank in the humid air. There are scars everywhere on his skin, and Django takes a breath, presses a thumb to the one that cuts across his lower lip. Surprise flickers in his eyes, and Django almost wants to laugh, almost wants to shake him just for the sheer aggravation of watching him fight and knowing he was a Jedi. Letting go of his robes, Django shoves a hand beneath them, finds torn cloth easily, feels the sharp hitch of breath, and laughs angrily even as his fingers find a wide strip of scar tissue, the exact size and shape of the Katarn's claws. "You criffing bastard!" he snarls, and the Jedi opens his mouth, but nothing in Django wants to hear what he has to say. He isn't thinking about Galadron, isn't thinking about the true Mandalorians or Death Watch or the Jedi's words on Slave One. All he's thinking about is the clean stroke that beheaded the Katarn, and that moment in the aftermath. Honor for a fallen enemy, but no regret, not weakness. And Django presses his fingertips into the wide, stark scar that curls up across the Jedi's ribs, cuts across more marks, scattered across his skin, wants to put his mouth on them, or maybe his teeth, just wants, heady and heavy and full of rage, and he splays his hand across lean muscle, shoves hard until the Jedi is fully pinned, and thinks. Doesn't think at all, because the Jedi tips his head, and that's invitation enough. Django grabs his hair, drags him down into a hard kiss, bruising, biting, feels the gasp, the jerk. But when that Jedi's hands come up, they wrap around Django instead of pushing him away. Don't pull, don't grab. And Django hates the politeness. He jerks the Jedi's hair, shoves into his mouth in an aggressive, aggravated kiss, and bites at those scarred lips until the Jedi starts kissing back. Like he's been given permission, he presses forward, meeting each of Django's bruising kisses eagerly. And Django likes that. Likes it too much, sharp in his chest, and he shoves ragged tunics aside, pulls off the wide sash and lets it drop. "How the carking hell did you survive that?" he says, almost a growl, and digs his thumb into the Katarn's marks. The Jedi laughs a little, soft and rough and breathless, right against his mouth. "I'm good at surviving," he says, and the hand on Django's back curls, tugs. Django goes with it willingly, pressing himself up against the Jedi and gripping his ribs, fingertips feeling out the deep scars as he fits their mouths together again. Against his back, the Jedi's fingers curl, then spread, dragging down in a long, slow stroke as Django kisses him, deep and edged with teeth. Unerringly, his hands find Django's own scars, hidden beneath the bulk of his armor. And there's a hitching breath against his mouth, a sound low as Django pulls away to graze his teeth across the indent in his lip, and the Jedi murmurs, "It looks like you are, too." Django doesn't answer, just gets a hand around his hip and shoves. The Jedi laughs at being shoved back into the wall, a bare rasp of sound, and doesn't hesitate. He lets Django crowd him up against the wood, a knee between his thighs, mouth slanting over his. And Django wants to cover him, wants to keep going and rot against him and strip him down to nothing but bare skin, see all those scars for himself. They're at the edge of town, though, right in the open, and that should matter a hell of a lot more than it does right now. "This how you avoid bounty hunters?" Django demands, tearing their mouths apart, and there's heat coiling in his belly, crawling up his spine with claws. It's hard to think through the roaring want, the bloody, bullheaded desire to get this idiot Jetty on his back with Django's mouth on his skin. That gets him a flash of teeth, more challenge than smile, full of something dark that makes Django's dick ache. I don't need to avoid bounty hunters, the Jedi says. And Django makes a sound of fury, gets his fingers in that mud-splattered hair again, and hulls the Jedi down. He's got inches on Django, but he yields easily, lets Django push him back and down. They slide down the wall, hit the ground with Django on his knees between the Jedi's spread thighs. And like this, at least, Django has the height advantage. He tips the Jedi's head back, takes his mouth again, and the soft sound against his lips is almost enough to make him dizzy. Arrogant bastard, Django growls, and the Jedi opens his eyes, blown dark, gaze entirely unrepentant. He raises a cool brow, and Django pushes him back again, gets a hand on his chest and scrapes his nails across the scarred skin, watches the Jedi jerk and buck, mouth opening, and fits his own over it, a lazy, sloppy kiss as he twists his fingers tighter in black hair. I'm still alive, aren't I? The Jedi murmurs, and Django can't help but snort, turning his head to drag his mouth over a scar that slants across his cheek. For now, he says, makes it a threat. But instead of being appropriately cowed, the Jedi pulls him in tighter, hands sliding down to Django's ass. Django grunts and has to catch himself on the wall and bites the Jedi's throat in retaliation. One sharp pinch of teeth that makes him jerk. His voice breaks on a moan, and Django has to close his eyes, breathe deep. He has a Jedi under him, and all he wants is to kiss him more. Could kill him. Could draw his blaster or a vibroblade right this instant and cut his throat, but Django doesn't even know if it would work, if he'd manage it regardless of how close he is right now, and somehow that's hotter than anything else. Is this your clever plan to get close enough to kill me? The Jedi asks, and Django pulls his head back with a tug at his hair, kisses the sharp line of his jaw, and gets his teeth over that vulnerable beat of his pulse, quick beneath the skin. Gently, carefully, he presses his tongue to it, then his teeth, and feels the Jedi shudder against him. It's working, isn't it? He asks, and the Jedi closes his eyes and moans quietly, one hand going to the back of Django's head, pulling him in, tugging him close. Django chuckles smugly, applies his teeth to the scarred skin. Burn scars here, pale against the rest of his skin, off-center, but curving around towards his chin. And Django traces them with his mouth, strokes his free hand down the Jedi's chest, firm and slow. With a low, rough sound, the Jedi grips the back of Django's head, his shoulder blade. A foot hooks over Django's, a thigh trying to pull him closer, and Django nips, gets a jerk in response, then catches the Jedi's mouth again, tilting his head back, bearing down. And his soft, uneven breaths are too appealing, too hot. Django wants to press him flat, work his way down his body, take him apart. He thinks of the Jedi in the swamp, landing on one knee as the Katarn fell. The green glow of his lightsaber, the shadow of his cloak, the blood on his skin even as his expression was so steady and certain. A fighter, dangerous and able to use tricks Django has never seen any Jedi use before, but Django wants it. He wants him. And it's stupid and reckless in a way Django doesn't let himself be, but he lifts his head, turns the tight grip on the Jedi's hair into a gentle drag of fingers, and watches those pale eyes slide open to look at him. Let's get a room, he wants to say. But as he opens his mouth to make the offer, thunder rolls. 5 seconds of warning is all Django gets before the sky opens up and absolutely drenches them. Django growls, but the rain is so torrential that he can hardly see the Jedi's face from inches away. And despite what all those terrible holos Zam watches would have Django believe, There's absolutely nothing romantic about suddenly being soggy, freezing, and in danger of drowning. Criff, but Django hates swamp planets. From under him, still pressed against the wall, the Jedi snorts. He glances up at the heavy clouds, then immediately drops his eyes when the rain proves too heavy even for Jedi idiocy, and says, with a sort of equanimous resignation, "Even the chrysalids won't be out in this, at least." What Django feels is not a flare of regret. He doesn't give a damn if the Jedi isn't going out to pick more fights with things bigger than him. All of this was a bad idea anyway, and Django has terrible taste in men, and the Jedi watches him shove to his feet, propped against the boards with one knee pulled up, his tunic slipping off of him. His skin is weathered brown and scattered with pale scars, rain sliding down his chest as he studies Django, apparently oblivious to the picture he makes. It's not an artful pose, isn't meant to be alluring, but that just makes Django want to haul him up and into the nearest bed even more. Django closes his eyes. "Terrible taste. That's all this is. He saw the fight, and that was attractive enough to make him think this criffing hobo Jedi bastard was someone he needed to fuck." Deliberately, determinedly, he ignores the knowledge that if the Jedi offered up his room key right this moment, Django would take him up on it instantly and without regret. Bending down, Django picks up his helmet, tucks it under his arm. "Don't get in the way of my bounty," he warns the Jedi, who doesn't move, doesn't answer. He just observes Django for a long moment, silent, soaked, and then sits up, leaning forward to rest an arm on his raised knee. "Be careful in the swamp," is all he says, and Django turns and walks away, because if he stays, he's going to do something stupid. Well, stupider.